Hello and welcome to USSOcast, a US Studies online podcast. In this series, myself and Sarah Collier chat to PhDs and ECRs about their research, their life in academia, and all things in between. This week, we are joined by Tim Galsworthy, a PhD student in American history at the University of Sussex. Tim, welcome. How are you?
Not too bad. Still reveling in Liverpool's glory from the weekend. And we won't mention Villa's result, will we?
No, I don't want to talk about football at all at the beginning of this podcast. I guess I'll start this episode how we started all the others, which is, can you tell us a little bit about your research? And feel free to go into as much detail as you'd like.
Yeah, well, my PhD research, in a nutshell, is looking at the relationship between Civil War memory, so the memory of the American Civil War, and the Republican Party during the Civil Rights era. I'm focusing on 1960 to 68 for the sense of manageability, but also that covers the 4 or 5 years of the Civil War centennial. And it's, you know, it's a pretty important moment in America in terms of civil rights and in terms of the Republican Party. So what I look at is how I essentially conceive my project as an intra-party study. So I'm looking at how Republicans of different persuasions are using the memory of the Civil War to try and fight and win intra-party battles. So there's kind of progressive Republicans like Nelson Rockefeller. There's Black Republicans such as Jackie Robinson, who are primarily aligned with the progressives, conservatives like Barry Goldwater, and a growing band of Southern Republicans like Strom Thurmond. And it's all about how they use different, similar, contested, competing memories of the Civil War to try and win control of the party, essentially, to try and win the argument, to try and win elections, and to try and win control of the GOP. So that's it in a nutshell. I could ramble on forever, take up more than this podcast and then again. So I'll stop there at that point.
No, that's great. And definitely save some of the stuff you didn't say for later, because I'm sure we'll come back to it.
Thanks, Tim. Yeah, I'm really interested in your use of the word memories, plural. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering how you're defining memory through your research. Are we looking at sort of collective, cultural, a range of those things?
Yeah, this is always the fun bit. This is the kind of theoretical bit that's the least fun bit of doing memory studies. And what I tend to do, I use memory and memories in the sense that there isn't one fixed memory, and I tend to lean towards historical memory more than collective, because as much as I'm trying to bring in ordinary people throughout my work, so much of it is focused on kind of political elites or political activists. So I tend to go with historical memory or historical memories. And in my framing, I try to lean on sort of Hobsbawm, Halbach, Jay Winter, people like that. And in its simplest terms, I think of memory as being constructed. It's presentist, so i.e. it's determined by what contemporary needs are. So when a politician invokes the Civil War, it's less about the Civil War and more about their needs in the present day, you know, an argument they're trying to get across. And it's important to think of it as constructed in conversation between elites and kind of ordinary citizens. And that's where kind of John Bodner in an American context comes in. He talks about official and vernacular memory, which is a good way of thinking about it. So I lean towards historical memory, and how it's used by politicians, how it's constructed by politicians, but then also how the public and the press and people are responding to it.
Do you think that use of memory has changed over the decades from the 20th century through to now? Or is it kind of like that idea of memory and appealing to memory and elements of nostalgia, etc., is kind of timeless in American politics? I don't know.
I think it's timeless in many ways. I think in terms of memory studies is having a bit of a boom and has had a bit of a boom since the 80s and 90s, particularly kind of after the fall of communism. And there's a real question of memory in kind of post-communist society. And then you go to reckoning with the memory of the Holocaust. But in terms of right now, there's a real renaissance in memory studies, you know, with all the Confederate monuments coming down and the big debates over kind of Black Lives Matter, Rhodes Must Fall, Colston Statue. You know, there's a, particularly in Anglo-American and European, but also worldwide, there's a big discussion of memory. In American politics, I think nostalgia has always been central. I mean, you go back, George Washington is cast as America's Cincinnatus, which is a reference to a Roman general who leaves his farm to go and fight to save Rome and then goes back to his farm. And that's the image that George Washington wants to create. So nostalgia and created, constructed memory has been in American politics since the United States existed, yeah, and before. And in, you know, in a Republican context, which I look at, any Republican worth their salt pretty much has to make a claim to Lincoln. If you're not saying, well, you know, we're the party of Lincoln, or I'm best befitting Lincoln, you're not a Republican. Even Trump does it. You know, Trump is not backward in coming forward about how great he is. And the only president he seems to think anywhere near as good as him, along with Andrew Jackson, is Abraham Lincoln. Like, they're the only ones he ever seems to think are anywhere near as good as him. So present day, all the way back from when the Republican Party's founded, it's, you have to make good with Lincoln if you want to be a Republican. Largely. Yeah,
what you just said about Washington as well, like, there's the whole nostalgic thing with Lincoln leaving Springfield, Illinois, and the kind of the speech he gives on the train as he goes to Washington, you know, kind of much eulogized now. But yeah, that nostalgia and that appealing to that.
And then going back as part of the funeral. Exactly. I mean, and that funeral's the kind of the funeral, obviously, then the Kennedy funeral. Jackie Kennedy models that on the Lincoln funeral. It's the same. Is it the kind of thing that Kennedy's laid on in the Capitol? It's the same one that Lincoln was laid on, I think.
Really?
And then Bobby Kennedy's funeral train, you know, that's an ode to Lincoln as well, I think. So, you know, it's become, by the 20th century, sort of by FDR, Lincoln is nonpartisan as well. You have to claim Lincoln if you want to win. Obama launches his 2008 presidential campaign in Springfield, you know, on the steps, you know, Lincoln spoke here and all that. So any politician in America has to, so to an extent, I mean, some of the people I look at, because they're kind of Southern segregationists who talk a lot more about the Confederacy, they're not so keen on Lincoln. But even then, occasionally kind of Lincoln references slip in, and there is a segregationist Lincoln. I often say that everyone from a socialist to a segregationist has to claim Lincoln in the US, which is a good way of thinking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, while we're still talking about your research, getting a little bit more specific, you were the recipient of the 2021 Bass Peter Parish Award. Can you tell us a little bit about, firstly, before you tell us about what that entailed in terms of, you know, working with the Library of Congress, how did you find out about it? What was the process like in applying? Just talk us through that kind of research process.
Yeah, well, like any kind of British-based Americanists, whether that be in history or English or American studies, whatever, it's kind of routine. You apply for a Bass Award every year. I'm sure listeners, you know, they'll go.
You've knocked on the door a few times, then.
I've applied. I'm in my fourth year now. So when I got it, I was in my third year, and I'd applied in first year and second year, and then finally success in third year. But you know, it's the pretty much similar process to most awards, I guess. You see it advertised, you put together your proposal. Here's why my research is so great, but to be even greater, it needs this archive collection, or it needs this archive here, please give me some money. And I think certainly in a COVID context, and I'm sure we'll come on to discuss COVID, every money, you know, not to copy Tesco, but every little helps when it comes to money at the moment. And with archives being shut and not being able to get to the States, having money to pay for kind of research funds is massively important. So and I found out about it, it must have been March, I think, I found out about it, and then I had to keep quiet until the awards ceremony, which is very exciting. And then there was an online awards ceremony, and my partner made me a hat that says "Thank you, Bass." It's still up there.
I think I remember seeing that on Twitter.
Still up there on the shelf.
Love that.
Which was great, and it was nice, you know, to share it with a few people, and to have an award. You know, Peter Parish is a massive historian of the Civil War, one of the leading. You know, he's a British historian that was able to have success in the United States as a civil, you know, that people in the US read his books, and that's, you know, having an award named for him is incredibly humbling. But you know, it's always nice when you apply for all these awards and you've not been successful, you know, it's nice to be successful.
It's nice to win one.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
How did you find the process then of finding an independent researcher? So obviously, because of the COVID circumstances, it could be avoided, but I wondered how you sort of came to that decision.
Yeah, so what I mean I can tell a broader story if I got that. I was in the US in March 2020 when everything was kind of kicking off.
Wow.
And I probably shouldn't have gone. I went in early March, and I was going to the Nixon Library, the Reagan Library, and then Arizona State. And I got to the Thursday of my first week at the Nixon Library, and they said everything's closing. And I was like, what do I do? I flew home very quickly, which proved to be a great decision. giving the lockdowns and everything, you know, to, I didn't want to be stuck in the United States, and I managed to get back. And then I was kind of, until 2021, I was a little bit stuck of, well, what am I supposed to do? Do I just wait? I was meant to be going on another research trip last summer 2020. That never happened. And as it was going on, I realized, actually, I need to investigate alternatives. I need to find independent researchers that can copy some of this material for me. Mm-hmm. And I'd started doing that anyway with a few other archives. So Virginia Commonwealth, which Virginia Commonwealth University and a couple of other institutions, I'd contacted the archivists and they put me in contact with independent researchers. Another award I had from an institution in South Carolina, they used the funds to directly pay for an independent researcher to do it rather than giving me the funds. So when I saw the BAS one, and I saw that for BAS this time it was in person and or independent researcher, I reached out to the Library of Congress and kind of talked to the archivists about options, because I didn't know, with it being, you know, a national institution, whether they'd be a bit funny about independent researchers, but they gave me a list. I contacted a couple. Dr. Jay Driscoll, who I mentioned in the blog post, got back to me very, very quickly, and it was very, very clear how he would work, and that was great. So when I put in my application to BAS, I was able to give very detailed costs, very detailed explanations of how I would use an independent researcher, who I would use, how I'd found them, what they'd be able to do in a time frame. And I don't know, I'm not on the awards committee, obviously, but I'm not sure that didn't help me in getting an award, because I'd made it clear that I'd done the research into independent researchers and that I'd made a clear case for how the BAS award funds would be used by an independent researcher. So it's always the case of, it's sometimes in PhDs, I feel like we think we have to spend all our time doing the research or doing the writing. Actually setting a bit of time aside to do the admin and to do the admin properly helps you do the research and the writing. Because if, you know, I'm a historian, if I haven't got archival material, I can't write anything. So I think taking the time to work out what the options were for independent researchers, who was the best, what would it cost, how could I fund it? I think that stood me in good stead for when I applied for the BAS Award and then ultimately getting the BAS Award.
Yeah, I think that specificity is so important. Anytime I've applied for anything, that's the advice I've been given. Like, the more you can itemize and inventory the things you're going to do, you know, the better standing you're going to be in. This whole kind of process, is this something you'd recommend to others, the way you work with the Library of Congress using an independent researcher? I mean, I find it interesting that they have like a list on hand to give you if people to contact. I mean, that's a really useful resource. But generally speaking, is this something you'd recommend to others, how you found it?
I wouldn't be able to. I'm not as far on with my PhD as I'd like to be in my fourth year, but I have lost a year of research thanks to the pandemic. But I wouldn't be in the position I'm in now, where I have pretty much all my archival material and a large portion of my thesis written without independent researchers. Because, you know, I've not been able or been willing to travel to the United States. I mean, I know we're allowed to go now, but I'm not going anywhere near. Personally, I don't want to go and to some of the places I need to go. The vaccination rate is shockingly low. And I don't really want to go and put myself or my loved ones in danger. So without, you know, independent researchers in places like South Carolina, without working with archives in Mississippi, sometimes it's not even independent researchers, it's the archivists themselves. They will scan you the stuff and you'll pay for it. Without independent research researchers and without, you know, paying archivists rather than going, I wouldn't be able to do my PhD. It'd be a 7-8 year project, which I can't afford to do. And I also think it's something to keep in mind is, I actually think this might be the way that some research goes, because we're not only dealing with a COVID pandemic, we're dealing with the climate change and climate change emergency of cutting down on flying, cutting down on our climate footprint. And if we can get stuff sent to us remotely for the same price or even a lesser price than going flying to the other side of the world, I don't see why we shouldn't do that. And yes, you don't have the serendipity of finding things in archives. Yes, you have to look through a load of PDFs with a load of rubbish that you don't really want, and you've no idea what's in a file. But this is the world we now live in. So I think I would recommend independent researchers. I would really, if you're starting out, wherever you are in a PhD, if there's an archive and there's stuff you want, just ask them and look on their website and ask them, what are the reproduction processes? You know, can you put me in contact with an independent researcher? Is there a way archivists do it themselves? It's an absolute godsend. It's been an absolute godsend for my PhD.
I mean, I'm so fortunate in that I really don't rely too heavily on archive work. And like, you know, hearing you are the complete other end of the spectrum in that regard, you say you wouldn't have been able to do what you have done. It would take another 7 years. So yeah, this award really was a blessing in many ways. I mean, Sarah, do you rely on archival work in the same way? I feel like in a very privileged position sitting here, like, you know, that I don't have to worry about the things that Tim's worried about.
Yeah, no, I'm the same. I don't really rely on archives at all. But I love talking to people about whatever they find in their archives. Yeah. I always find those conversations really fascinating. So I was going to say, Tim, was there any... Well, first of all, did you notice any huge differences in the kind of, like, effective way that you dealt with the archives, sort of between seeing them in the flesh and remotely? And also, what was your favourite? What did you find that you really liked engaging with?
Well, I think the thing is my archive process, because the nature of my project, it's very disparate in terms of the papers. It's very disparate in terms of the topics. So often when I've been to I was lucky enough to go to the United States in summer 2019 and obviously early 2020 before the pandemic kicked in. And my kind of research process is kind of hoovering up. So you go, take lots of photographs, mm-hmm. and then you deal with it when you get home and you type them up kind of off your camera. Yeah. So in many ways, it wasn't that dissimilar in that I got the material and then I typed it up. So it wasn't that dissimilar a process. It was more just I hadn't found it. So I didn't have a sense already of what was there. Whereas obviously, even though I'm taking photographs of things rather than typing it up in an archive, I'd be like, oh, I remember that really great speech. Or I remember that really great letter. And I can't wait to find that. You don't have that. So it's a little bit more of a magical mystery tour of what actually is going to be in what you discover. But in other ways, it's much more useful in some ways, because perhaps this is my disorganization. Sometimes you've just got lots and lots of photographs and it's a little bit chaotic. If an archivist is sending you folders, it's very itemized and it's very clear. So often it's much easier to find things at a later stage. So it's slightly different in that you just kind of sit at a computer screen going through PDFs. But that's, I guess, no difference than sitting at a computer screen and going through photographs that you've taken. There's only just a slight degree of separation. In terms of the best, you know, archivists are brilliant. I love archives. I volunteered in one for a bit during my undergrad, so I have nothing but without archivists, the historical profession would fall apart. Frankly, they're more important than anything I'll ever do, because they contribute to so many different people's projects. In terms of the best things I've found, I've found lots of things. That's part of the problem with trying to write this thesis, is there's too many good things. From the Library of Congress, I think the most interesting thing I found, but something I mentioned in the blog, was actually an absence of Civil War memory. You know, I spend most of my time kind of looking for Civil War memory, which can make it really long. You're looking through speeches and no one's saying anything. You're like, well, this is useless. And I'd expected with Edward Brooke, if people don't know who Edward Brooke is, he was elected to the US Senate to represent Massachusetts in 1966. He was the first Black senator since Reconstruction. He was a Republican. And I'd expected his 1966 campaign to be filled with lots of Lincoln and Party of Emancipation and fulfilling Reconstruction. And there really wasn't that much. There was occasional nods, but nothing out of the ordinary. And that got me to thinking, you know, he's trying to represent a state that is 97% white. And perhaps that's why he doesn't want to be, you know, in a context of Black power, he doesn't want to be seen as a Stokely Carmichael. He doesn't want to be seen as a radical. So he has to perhaps tone down his civil rights rhetoric and tone down Civil War memory as part of it. So, you know, and that's something my supervisors have mentioned before. It's not just where the memory exists, it's where it doesn't. Looking for the silences as well as the kind of loud shouting in archives. So I think that was really interesting. And then the other, perhaps the most interesting thing I found from the Library of Congress archives are some public letters, which I also mentioned in the blog, from a Baptist minister in Gary, Indiana, called L.K. Jackson. And I don't want to give too much away, because kind of L.K. Jackson is, I'm parking him for my post-PhD project of what I want to do next. But I first came across him at the Rockefeller Archive Center in Tarrytown, which I would recommend anyone, if you want to go to an archive, that's an amazing archive. You go to the toilet in John D. Rockefeller's bathroom. I mean, if that's not...
As in his personal bathroom?
As in a bathroom he built, because it's their old house. So if that's not an interesting archive experience, and I don't know what it is.
Hallowed movements.
You know, hallowed... Yeah, well, couldn't possibly comment. And I, you know, these open letters that he writes throughout the 60s and throughout the 50s to Republican leaders, and talks about how kind of Southern white Republicans are marching under the banner of Lincoln, but doing the bedding of Jefferson Davis. And it's just amazing stuff. And I think they're probably the most exciting things I've ever come across in an archive, along with kind of letters from white Southerners, where there's this amazing letter I found from a guy in Mississippi saying that he was voting for Goldwater and that his two Confederate grandfathers would vote for Goldwater. And I'm like, that's just, you know, yeah. I did the archive. Perfect. I did the archive dance.
Yeah.
And you know, so, and I think that's the only thing, that it's less exciting when you find something really exciting when you're sat in your study typing at a computer than when you're in an archive in America. Mm. Like finding something in an archive, it's much more exciting. Although that being said, if I find something when I'm sat at home, I can shout and swear and leap in the air and no one will think I'm strange. Because if you do that in an archive, you're going to get
thrown out.
Yeah. So there's the pros and cons to the kind of researching from home versus researching in an archive. Again, I could keep going of other things I found in archives, but I guess you'll just have to wait for the thesis/article/book, won't you?
Yes,
and for all the future
projects after the PhD as well, from the sounds of it. I've got a really frivolous question now. You mentioned like receiving a lot of work from these research assistants. It's very itemized, very organized. You mentioned in your article a very heavily color-coded system when you sent your work. So describe, kind of pull the curtain back a little bit on what you actually sent kind of notes-wise, because I wouldn't even know where to start with all
this. Well, I can tell you two things about the color coordinate system. So on a base level, when I do research and I'm typing stuff up, I color coordinate. So really, really important in titles is purple. Really important is red. Examples is orange, and quotes is green. Okay. And counterpoints, so negatives and counter criticism, is blue.
It's a real rainbow going on.
I've had that system since I was an undergrad, and it seems to have worked so far. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's all about finding a system that works for you. I know people that handwrite everything, which I find absolutely chaotic. But if it works for people, it works for people. Yeah. So what I would send to an archive, what I would tend to do is I've got lots of these Word documents, and I'd go through the finding aid and I'd type out what I wanted, and I'd make it really, really clear. So this is the papers, you know, series, subseries, box, folder, giving as much detail as I can. And that's another thing I'd say. If you're working with independent researchers or archivists, give them as much detail as possible. If you're like, oh, I'd like some stuff from Joe or Josephine Blogg's papers, it's not helpful. Whereas if you want folder 4 in box 5, you know, you're being helpful. And archivists like people who are helpful. You know, we all like people who are helpful. We have enough to do on a PhD. So what I would tend to do is I'd type out everything I wanted. Anything that I'd be like, well, that'd be nice, but I'm not really that bothered about it, I'd put in blue. So that's for if you get chance, you can look at that.
Yeah.
But perhaps the bit where I'd start complicating it is I'd try and prioritize it. So I'd put like in brackets next to folders or boxes, you know, priority 1, priority 2, priority 3. And sometimes it'd be a little bit all over the Word document. And it makes sense to me, but I worry that it wouldn't make sense to independent researchers. But it seems to have done so far. They seem to understand my priority system. The only chaos is when I go back through it and realize, oh, I've got the numbers wrong. So suddenly you've got a 2A and a 3B. And I'm like, that's probably less helpful.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's just about being detailed, giving as much steer as possible. I think a lot of people, when they're requesting stuff from archives, they're not requesting as much as me. It's one or two folders, but by the nature of I trying to gather a lot of material related to a lot of different topics, I'm often asking for a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I've done it. But my color coordination, I love it. Other people who've seen it are like, what is this chaos? Because it just looks like a splurge of color. On my screen, but it's worked for me for 4 or 5 years through the end of my, you know, undergrad, masters and PhD, so it works. I think
that's the beauty of it. I think you find a system that works for you, and you know, it doesn't matter what others think. Did you have any other questions, Sarah?
Just what's next for you?
What's next? Well, I need to finish the thesis. My target my target is September 2022. That would be 4 years from when I started. That would be the end of my kind of official registration at Sussex. So that's my target. I've got a plan for doing that, you know, in terms of, you know, I've got a supervision tomorrow, actually. And then the plan kind of for the up until Christmas is to write another chapter. Mm-hmm. And I've got a little bit more research after Christmas, then another chapter. Then the whole thing is drafted. And then it's a case of going back through it with a fine tooth comb, because I've not written it in chronological order by the nature of the archives I found. So I need to kind of, because it's in, I'm writing it in chronological order, I need to go back through and make sure there's that line of argument. So it's finishing it off, essentially. And I'm feeling okay about it. I'm at that stage now where I think I know the material. It's just a case of, like Andre Previn, of putting it all in the right order. At the moment. After that, God knows. I mean, who, academic job market, that's a whole other podcast.
We don't have enough time to talk about that.
So, I mean, I guess just hope, you know, try and find something going forward. And, you know, I've got a journal article under consideration at the moment. I had revise and resubmit, so I've resubmitted it. So hopefully that will be accepted. And the aim is to kind of try and get a second one in the works in and around, you know, in that kind of weird window between submission and Viva, try and piece something together. And then, yeah, just try and get a job, try and make enough money to, you know, to survive. all those joys. And then, yeah, just see from there, really. And try and still, you know, what I try to remember is why I'm doing this, and the fact that I love the topic, and I think I am finding interesting things. And I think if we look at the Republican Party today, the Republican Party is a neo-Confederate party. It openly embraces Confederate memory. It's openly embracing a new lost cause in the idea that Trump won. Yeah. That's the new lost cause.
And yeah.
Trump won on my birthday while I was doing my master's. So if that's not a sign that I needed to do the research I wanted to do, I don't know what is. Mm. So, you know, and I think I have something interesting to say to the kind of historiography, to the scholarship. But I also think thinking about Republican Party and Civil War memory, thinking about divisions within the Republican Party, I think that's still more than relevant. You know, Liz Cheney invoked Lincoln when she spoke out against other members of her own party. So I think it's still an ongoing process and story. And for me, that's the role of scholars as historians, isn't it? You know, Michael Gove might say that there's no more room for experts, but I think there is. And I hope to think one day, if we just keep speaking, maybe the public might listen at some point. Hopefully, maybe that's, who knows?
Well, speaking of jobs and experience and, you know, why we do what we do, we know that you've started teaching again recently. We had a kind of a bit of a back and forth about this. Tell us what that's been like, getting back in the classroom, COVID pending, etc. Just, what's it feel like to be teaching again?
It's great to be back in the classroom. So I taught during COVID, first term 2020, so kind of the September to December last year. And teaching online, there are advantages in some ways, but it just didn't feel the same. To go from teaching in a classroom to teaching online just didn't feel right. And it was absolutely the right thing to do, obviously, because there was a pandemic. But being back in the classroom is great. It's not, you know, no disrespect to American studies, but I've taught two American studies courses. So it's nice to be teaching a history course, because I am a historian.
Well, you are a historian. I think so, that's,
you know,
fair,
it's nice to be teaching history. And it's interesting. Second years, and I think they're in a similar sort of situation of negotiating what it's like to be back on campus. But no, it's good, and it's good to be getting stuck into. I'm not teaching anything American this term, so it's very theoretical.
Really? Okay.
So I'm teaching. It's a second year core course about approaches to history. So Marxist, Whig, total, and micro history, kind of all these different historical approaches. So, you know, which is probably no bad thing for me to do, to try and get out of the American silo. And then next term I'm doing the coming of the American Civil War, which is going to be really exciting. Second year option course, 2-hour seminars, you know, real kind of special subject stuff, which will probably the kind of highest level I've taught at, which I'm really looking forward to. But no, it's nice to be teaching. I enjoy teaching. I did the AFHEA last year. So, you know, I like teaching, and I think you know, universities are an interesting place to be at the moment. Sussex is an interesting place to be at the moment, with a lot of things going on. And it's important to, you know, remember we do this because we love the research, and we teach because we want to try and find those kind of gems of inspiration that we found as undergraduates or master's students. We want to try and instill that in undergrads as well. I don't know if I'm doing that. I don't know if I'm actually a pretty terrible teacher. I've no idea. I talk far too much. So I'm probably not that great teacher. But hopefully, if I can get through to one student in the 3 years I've been teaching, I'll take that as a success.
Well, you make a great podcast guest, because you say you talk too much, Tim. You don't talk too much at all.
Well, maybe it's been on the other side of it, because early last year I was a research assistant on the BBC podcast You're Dead to Me.
Yeah, Greg Jenner does.
So I'd seen this from the other side. So really? Maybe I know. No, I don't know. Maybe I know.
You've seen where the sausage is made, so to speak. Yeah.
As you know, that's a line from Hamilton. Everything's a line from Hamilton, but I'm sure there's a line about seeing how the sausage is made. I've very much seen how the sausage is made and was involved in the making of the sausage process.
Wow.
So there you go.
No one else on the USSO cast podcast has said that before. So you know, history being made here. But we've been speaking for about half an hour. Don't want to keep you here forever, Tim. So we can probably wrap up now. But yeah, it's been really, really fascinating to hear about your research and obviously about the Peter Parish Award as well. Wish you the best of luck finishing your thesis September 2022. You know, yeah. God willing. And yeah, thank you so much for coming on.
No pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for letting me write the blog post. Thank you for having me on. And hopefully my ramblings are useful for somebody, if not to fill a bit of a Monday afternoon.
I'm sure they will be. Thank you so much, Tim.